Good morning, Breakfast Club. Just in case you guys weren't awake yet, I just thought I'd get a little energy in here. We were just talking about it. Robert and I went from, fifth grade to 12th grade. Now, I got expelled in 12th grade for smoking a cigarette in my car in the parking lot. But now, Robert was a straight-A student, you know. I'll tell you one other thing about Robert during all that time. There were some guys there that weren't, and some people there that weren't very nice to me. I was kind of the outsider. Robert was always one of those that was always very kind to me. And I appreciate that. I really do. I have fond memories of that. But he was a straight-A student during all of that. Turns out that in his qualifying to come in here, he went to jail more often than I did, too. So what we're dealing here with is an overachiever, okay? All right. Also, Robert is very active in AA in Atlanta, just recently serving as the chair for the Atlanta Roundup. And I watched him. I was down there volunteering, and you don't sit down very often in that job. So I know a lot about his story, but I wanted to share, not only to share Robert with you, but also to share you guys with Robert. So please come on up.
Thanks, Damon. My name is Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic. And that was a really kind introduction. I guess an overachiever is a good way to put an alcoholic, to describe an alcoholic. It seems like we will work hard to do good things, bad things, or almost anything. And I know that's sort of been my case. And, you know, I'm really pleased to be here at the Breakfast Club because I am here with a bunch of people that want to be sober. When I think about my life, say 20 years ago at 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning, there's one of two things going on. I'm either passed out in the bed wondering how I'm going to face the day, or I'm still out drinking. You know, there might have been the chance I was getting up and starting early on a Saturday morning, but I was not out having breakfast with other people. That was very highly unlikely, unless it was a Waffle House after an all-night party or something like that. But I'm so glad I can be here with you, because when I say I'm an alcoholic, that's probably the most important thing that I can tell you about Robert Bell. What this means is that I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows, my average fellows. If you're an alcoholic like me, then we're sort of the same. What happens with me when I start drinking? I can't control how much I drink. I end up drinking until I get drunk, and then I keep on drinking. Now, there's a lot of my friends that I know that it'll be a game like tonight. There'll be a big football game. They'll go out and get drunk. Then they go home. See, if I get drunk at a football game and it's over at 10 or 11 at night, I want to go to downtown Atlanta. I want to see what's going on. There's more things to do. And so that's one part about me as being an alcoholic. But the greater dilemma is what happens to me when I'm not drinking. See, when I'm an alcoholic, I experience this discomfort when I'm not drinking. There's something that's going on. This happened to me even as a kid. Certainly happened once I started drinking and I knew what drinking would do for me. And the book describes it. And, you know, I wouldn't have known any of this kind of stuff. When I said I was an alcoholic, I could not have told you anything about this until I came to AA and hung around long enough to really start doing what you guys do and get a sponsor. And this sponsor helped me. He didn't tell me what to do, but he showed me what to do. And I want to tell you one thing that's going to relate to why I'm saying being an alcoholic is the most important thing about me. And I'm not kind of the kind of person that quotes the big book, but on page 44, it says, if when drinking you have a little control over the amount you take, which is what I just talked about, or if when you want to stop you cannot quit entirely, then you're probably alcoholic. And if this be the case, you're probably suffering from an illness which will require a spiritual solution. And see, I didn't understand that stuff. So I've got this problem when I'm not drinking that I can't quit entirely. And the book describes it as restless, irritable, and discontent. And here's me when I'm not drinking without a program of action that I get it through Alcoholics Anonymous, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm restless. What this means is no matter what's going on in my life, I start thinking. And somebody a moment ago said I was thinking and that was a problem. But you know, I start thinking about problems I've got. And it could be with my wife. It could be with work. It could be legal problems like Damon mentioned about. It could be problems I don't really even have, but I think about them. I lay in bed and think about them. I get up and think about them. And I am just restless. Then it says irritable. You know, irritable, it means I'm easily upset. Things bug me. I was talking with a new guy's sponsor. We're going through this. And I said, what does that mean to you? And he says, you know, I've always got this low level of being pissed off at the world. And I understood that. I thought that was the best definitions I've ever heard of irritable and discontented. It just seems like I'm not happy with life. You know, if I'm here, I want to be there. If I'm with her, I've got some other girl I've got my eyes on. If I'm working this job, I see a different job. I cannot just be satisfied with what's going on with me. When I'm facing being restless, irritable, and discontented, I see others get relief by drinking. See, I get them get relief by drinking. And so I'm in this mind frame of when I get this way and I understand what alcohol will do for me, that the only solution I really have till I get to Alcoholics Anonymous is take a drink. I want that ease and comfort. But I don't understand that other dilemma that I mentioned, that I'm going to drink till I get drunk. Nothing bad happens every time, but things do happen that are bad. So when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, that's the most important thing I can tell you about me, because it just describes sort of the essence of what occurred to me as a kid, as a teenager, as a young adult, and, you know, on through my life. And I can tell you it happens only with beverage alcohol. You know, I may drink other things. While I'm up here, I may have a sip of water. I may drink half of it. I get really thirsty, I may drink the whole thing. But I can tell you what is not going to happen. I'm not going to run out the store and buy a case of water and check myself in the hotel. See? This happens only with beverage alcohol. So this is the most important fact about Robert Bell. It is key. It's essential. It's critical that I remember it. And that's why I'm so glad I'm here at the Breakfast Club. You're a group of people that understands the fatal nature of alcoholism. Y'all gather here on Saturday mornings, and y'all get a chance to meet and fellowship. And I loved having the breakfast here, getting to meet some of Damon's friends. He said, you know, I want them to meet you, but I also want you to meet them. You know, I think the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is all important, and that'll come up in my story as well. So I'm really glad to be here, and I know that I absolutely believe that the things that I do on a day-to-day basis allow me to stay sober. I am not cured of alcoholism. What I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and y'all are helping me with that, and I hope that through what I say that I help somebody. So I was asked to tell my story, and I was born in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, I had parents that loved me. I probably grew up with everything I needed, most of the things that I wanted. I was given great educational opportunities. I got to go to school with Damon. I got to, you know, have the opportunity to go to college. I mean, I was just afforded all those opportunities. And I was given good religious training. I was taught right from wrong. My dad would have been described as honest as the day is long. And those are the type of attributes that they tried to demonstrate for me, tried to teach me. And, you know, some of the things caught on. I certainly remembered those things, even when I started sort of falling off that path. And I could tell you a variety of stories about as a kid where I started just doing the wrong thing. And I think about one time, you know, just one thing. I think about when I'm hanging out with some kids, I'm probably about 12. There was a 7-Eleven down the road from the school. You could ride your bike there. It wasn't that long a walk. And I remember some of the other kids, and some of them were a little bit older, would go in this convenience store, and they'd just steal candy and stuff like that. I knew it was wrong. But, you know, I sort of wanted to be one of the gang, and I can remember going in that store, taking that candy bar, sticking it in my pocket. We'd go out. We'd go around sort of up the hill and eating and joking with the guys, and somehow I felt a part of. And, you know, when you first do that, you're anxious. You're scared of getting caught. What'll happen if they catch me? By the second or third time, you're not nearly as anxious anymore, you know? And so that's sort of how these kind of things, that's sort of an introduction to maybe the way I view my alcoholism. There's a lot of other things that I could describe. But, you know, I can tell you the first time when I took a drink, and I can remember it just like it was almost yesterday. It was about this time of year, actually. I was 15 years old. I was at the high school that Damon and I went to. And I can remember I was sitting in front of the high school gym with my buddy Rex. Rex and I were just talking, and this van pulled up, and it was the McClellan brothers. The McClellan brothers lived up in Roswell. We were sort of in the Chestane Park area. And they pulled up, and these were two guys that we looked up to. They were older. It's a junior and a senior, Jim and John. And they had this Volkswagen van, and they were the kind of guys that I wanted to be like. They had long hair. They played in a band. They talked about going out with women. They talked about having sex with girls. You know, I'd had sex. It had always been menage a uno. But these were the kind of guys I wanted to hang out with, you know. And they slid that door open and said, Robert, Rex, y'all want to go out and have a couple beers? And we said, you bet. I looked at Rex. He had been drinking some before. He had an older brother. I never drank. We jumped in that van, and I was thinking I was going to have a couple beers. That's what they said. You want a couple beers? I'd see my dad drink at home. He'd come home from work. He'd have a couple of Jack Daniels and Coke. He might have a couple of beers. He'd read the newspaper, have dinner, go to bed, get up, go to work. I was thinking I was going to have a couple of beers. And one of the things that makes me alcoholic that I talked about earlier happened that time when I drank. I drank more than I thought I was going to drink. I was thinking I was going to have two beers. I ended up drinking six or seven. Nothing bad happened, but man, I loved what it did for me. We're driving around that van. I feel part of the group. We're talking about stuff. We go down by the Chattahoochee River. There's some people out there. We hang out with them for a while. It was a wonderful night. That's one of the things that makes me alcoholic. But that other part that I talked about, that happened too. Because when I woke up the next day, I don't know that I felt that bad. Certainly didn't get in trouble. No bad hangover. No real consequences. But I loved what it did for me, and I couldn't wait to drink again. And, you know, the drinking age back then was 18, so it was relatively easy to get alcohol. So I started just sort of drinking as weekend drinking kind of thing, going to parties. And, you know, this was the time, it was right post Woodstock. You know, a lot of stuff was going on, same kind of stuff that goes on now. But I was hanging around people that are drinking. I'll never forget, I was going around, it was probably a few months after that, with a guy named Drew. We're driving in his TR6, and I was in the passenger seat. We're drinking beer, just driving around, and he says, "Robert, look in the glove compartment." I looked in the glove compartment, and this plastic baggie fell out, and it was filled with weed and had some reefers rolled up in it. And I pulled it out. It wasn't the kind you have now, not the Ziploc. It's that kind, the sandwich bag that you lick the top of, and 10 or 15 people had licked it already. And it was that old 70s kind of pot with stems and seeds that popped and cracked and burned your shirt. Y'all know what I'm talking about, I see. And yet, I can remember he says, "You want to smoke this?" And I said, "You bet." So we smoked it. I don't know that I fell in love with smoking weed, but I can tell you what, it enhanced the effect of alcohol. You know, so I enjoyed smoking pot, drinking, and that sort of went on for a while. And you start doing those kind of things. Next thing you know, you're exposed to other things. And I was dating this woman, Cheryl, and she had come to our school just that year, and I started dating her. I can remember we were over at her parents' house, and her bedroom was in the back of the house, and her parents were up in the front of the house, and she invited me back to the bedroom, and I thought, this sounds good. So you go back to the bedroom, she shuts the door, and she goes through this ritual that I had seen in movies and TV, but I'd never done before, and she pulled out a mirror, she dumps this white powder on it, she chops it all up, pushes it into a few rails, and she pulls out a straw, and she bats her brown eyes at me and says, "If you snort this with me, I'll let you feel my boobs." Well, you can imagine what happened. I ended up drinking and doing drugs for about 25 years after that. And so, this is the point in many AA meetings where people apologize for their drug use. And I've had to apologize to a lot of people for my drug use, and you'll hear about it in a minute. But I had to apologize to my family for the shame and disrepute that I brought to the family when I got caught. And I had to apologize to school administrators and teachers really for only implementing a lot of things that they taught me about economics, about marketing, sales, distribution. And I also had to apologize to the police, and I'll get to that too. But in a group of alcoholics, I don't really see a big need to apologize for a little intermittent drug use between my drinking, see? And one way that I really know that I'm an alcoholic, I was watching people drink coffee over there, and you can sort of tell there's two types of people at an AA meeting. There's the people that are alcoholics, and there's the people that are addicts. And I could tell them because the people that are alcoholics get their sugar or their sweet and low and do this. And the people that are addicts do this over there. Y'all have recognized the difference too, I see. But when I say I'm alcoholic, I experience alcohol in the manner that I described earlier. When I drink, I can't control the amount that I drink. And I bring this up because there's a big night step amends that occurs because of this stuff. But my drinking was a lot like a lot of other people. You know, I started running into troubles here and there. There'd be troubles at home. There'd be troubles in relationships. There eventually started to be legal troubles. And I'm only going to tell a story or two about that. But I can remember I was supposed to head down to Jekyll Island to meet with some other high school kids. And a friend of mine, David, and I were supposed to drive down there from Athens down to Jekyll Island. And so we leave a baseball game on a Friday afternoon. And my parents were in my parents' car. And we're supposed to drive down there. And the drinking age is 18, and we had a cooler full of beer and some sandwiches. We were driving down there, and so I'm driving. David says, Robert, why don't you let me drive? Maybe he thought I was too drunk to drive. I don't exactly know why he wanted to drive, but I let him drive. I thought, this is great. So we're drinking, we're listening to music and singing to the music, having a good time, and we end up in Woodbine, which is not directly on the path to Jekyll Island, if you know Georgia geography. But anyway, the blue light comes on, and we get pulled over, and they arrest David for a DUI, and they throw me in jail for public drunkenness. And, you know, we get in there, and they say, who are you going to call to make bail? And David says, my parents are out of town, so I have to call my parents. And my dad was expecting a phone call from the hotel in Jekyll Island saying that I was there safely. He was not expecting a call from the jail saying I need to be bailed out, and he was upset. And it's one of those things, there was no screaming or yelling over the phone, but there was a firm tone, and I could tell he was upset. And he says, I'm going to send the money, but I want you back home, 5 o'clock, you know, get back here safely. And so the money gets there, we come up with some story and tell our friends while we slept on the side of the road or whatever, and we get back, and I'll never forget, we pull up at 5 o'clock at my parents' house, and my parents and David's parents are sitting on the front porch waiting for us. They read us the Riot Act. They talk about the evils of alcohol and drinking, how drinking and driving can be bad. And I tell you this story because if you had watched David drink, David was knocking him down left and right just like me. And when I think about the way he drank in high school, that was just the way he was. We'd go out, we'd get drunk. And I was doing the same thing. And I would have looked him and matched him up as the same, but he promised his parents he was going to quit. And you know what? He did quit. The Big Book talks about different types of drinker. It talks about the hard drinker that, given a sufficient reason, can moderate their drinking or stop. He was given a sufficient reason. He is able to do that. You know, I promised my parents the same thing, that I'm going to quit, and the next weekend or so, I'm back out there drinking again. See, there's a description of the real alcoholic, the person who suffers from alcoholism, the hopeless variety, that no matter what the consequences, they'll drink in face of it. And that's the type that I was, because I made those same promises. And if you looked at me and David, we appeared the same, but there was a difference. And I didn't understanding this stuff about alcoholism. So I keep drinking. I get out of high school. I go off to college in North Carolina. And I speed through this four-year college in 60 months. My ability to do schoolwork, like Damon described, was not as good by the time I got to college. It took me a bit longer than the regular four-year plan, but it did give me an opportunity to enjoy drinking. And, you know, I got out of college, and I hear people that say, you know, I don't understand how people that drink the way I drink could ever go to college, much less graduate from college. But let me tell you, I was able to get out of college because I can take tests. If you give me a multiple choice test, it's sort of like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. There's two answers that don't even make sense. You can sort of do 50-50, and I can come up with a good answer on a multiple choice test. And you give me a written test, I'm pretty good with coming up with stuff. I can get things, look it on paper, it makes sense, and I can do okay. But you give me a verbal test, and there's two or three people up here talking, I've got the other person outnumbered. See, I can take tests. But there was one test that I could not pass. I got out of college, and I found out this is one test I just could not pass. And it was a field sobriety test. And I found myself, shortly out of college, facing three DUIs. It was the early 80s, and I don't make light of DUIs. I know people in here have been impacted. If you look over the state of Georgia on a holiday weekend like Labor Day, there are people who will die at the hand of a drunken driver, and so I'm not making light of it. But I can tell you, I was in trouble. And back then, it wasn't as bad a trouble as it is now, but I knew I was in trouble. Got him in about a couple months period. I got an attorney. We went to court. He says, Robert, let me do all the talking. And I said, no joke, that's why I'm paying you. Definitely do all the talking. He says, but if the judge asks you a question, I give you the nod. That'll be okay. So this judge was looking at these tickets, and besides the arrest that I talked about, I'd been arrested for some other public drunkenness and things like this. So I had these three tickets for DUI. One was a car wreck, and he was looking at these, and he had this big printout. It was like those old tractor feed printouts, and it was for public drunkenness and stuff like that. And he looked at me, and he said, Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And my thought was, no, it's really all those Quaaludes I was eating. It's a real problem, you know. But, you know, there was objective evidence that I had, you know, not been able to control how much I drank. I'd do it at the risk of being, you know, going to jail. And this happened over and over. And you know, I was able to dodge the bullet. I had money to pay the attorney, and I don't know what he did with the money. I have this feeling that he and the judge got together in the back room, and I dodged that bullet. You know, I paid some fines, no real consequences. So I kept drinking, and you know, it was about this time, I can remember shortly after this, I had one of these nights where it was a long weekend. It might have been a long holiday weekend. It was one of those times where the drinking starts on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, and by Saturday night, I was just over. Something had happened. I don't know what it was, but internally, I felt awful. I'd been drinking a lot, doing cocaine and Quaaludes, and I got up the next day, and I thought, this has got to quit. And, you know, I was able to quit that cocaine and Quaalude habit, and it's not that tough. And you know how you do it? If you go to the liquor store every day and buy a fifth of Old Granddad, you can get rid of that other stuff right out of your life. And that's what I did. I just started drinking. It's socially acceptable. And I also thought, you know, I may need some help with all these problems I got. And growing up, I'd been going to church. So I thought, I'm going to go back to church. Maybe I'll find somebody. I did not find a solution to my alcoholism or drugs or anything else, really. But while I was there, I did end up meeting this woman. I met my first wife. There was a key word there, first, you know. But I met Teresa. I fell in love, and, you know, we got married. And when a woman like that meets a man like me, it's the end of all her problems. It's the front end of all her problems is what it is, you know. And she didn't know that she was married an alcoholic. I hit it relatively well. She didn't mind a little drinking, but she didn't want drunkenness. And I would do things like this. It could be a Saturday night. It'd be a night like tonight where there's going to be a big football game, the Alabama game. And I'd say, you know, I'm going to see my buddy Trey, and we're going to stop at the bar and just have a couple of beers. I'll be home at 7. And that'd be the kind of thing I'd tell my wife. And if you'd hooked me up to lie detector tests, I'd have been telling the truth. I did not understand that whole thing that the Big Book gets to, that phenomenon of craving. I have a couple of beers. I'm watching the football game. It's the end of the first quarter, and it's tied 14-14. It's a really great offensive game, and I don't want to miss the next play. I'm going to stay just for one more beer. Next thing I know, it's 10:30 at night. It's been a great game, but I'm drunk. I've already missed dinner, so I'm not too worried about that, and I don't want to disturb anybody by calling home. So I'm just going to hang out, have a few more beers, and I end up going home. You know, I show up to Alcoholics Anonymous, and people say, how does your alcoholism affect others? I say, my alcoholism doesn't affect anybody. It's only hurting me. See, I say these kind of things, and yet the Big Book tells me that selfishness and self-centered, that we think is the root of our troubles. I can't see the people that I'm harming by my drinking. Now, if you had asked my wife, she could have told you a different story about how my alcoholism was impacting her. If you'd asked people I work for, if you've asked other family members, if you'd asked friends, that alcoholism would just take over. And see, I'm self-centered whether I'm drinking or not, but this alcohol, it just fuels that fire. And so that's the kind of thing that happens over and over. And, you know, we were trying to have children, too. Our friends were having children, and we were having problems having children. My wife goes to the doctor, and they say, your husband needs to go, too. So I go to the doctor, and meanwhile, I find out I need to have this elective surgery, and so she's getting the stuff done she needs to. I have this elective surgery. It's going to be a small little abdominal surgery, and the surgeon schedules it for a couple months out, and at that point, I'm not too worried about it. But I go in about a week ahead of time for some pre-surgery testing, blood work, this and that. And I've been thinking about it, and I said, isn't abdominal surgery going to be painful? And the doctor says, oh, yeah, that's why we keep you in the hospital a couple days. I said, well, when I get out, will it still be painful? He says, yeah, but we've got an appropriate treatment for that. It's narcotic medication. And I was okay with the treatment that he offered. And so, you know, I went in, I got that operation, I got out, and they gave me these pills. And I had never really taken pain pills, but I noted that it said take one or two every hour may cause drowsiness, and one or two every 4 hours. And I thought, maybe if I take a few more of these. And so I started playing around with these pills, and I found that if you took, say, 4 every 2 hours or even more than that, you got this sense of ease and comfort, sort of like I got from drinking. And this gave me an idea. And and it was actually this plan I came up with. I thought that, you know, my wife didn't like, and let me ask you this, though. How many people are, like, in their first 6 months of sobriety? Are there a few here? Yeah, well, good. Well, welcome. We're glad you're here at AA. And when I was new in AA and before I got to AA, I had these plans. And if you're new and you have a plan, the best thing you could do is tell us your plan. Because here was my plan. And when you listen to this plan, you'll see why this is the kind of thing that needs to be shared. So the plan was I traveled for a living. And the idea was when I'm traveling, I can go out and drink the way I want to. No need to worry. I'm staying at a hotel. No problems that come from drinking at home, my wife being upset and all that kind of stuff. When I'm in town, I'll just pop these pills. And I'll sort of get this ease and comfort that I mentioned earlier, and my wife won't know I'm drinking. There's a problem with that. There's several problems. There's a whole host of problems, actually. One problem is, if you're laying on the floor unconscious, whether they can smell the liquor or not makes no difference. They know something's up. Another fault to this plan is they did not give me sufficient pills for this plan to work. And so I had to go to my personal physician and let him know about this discomfort I was experiencing and do it in abdominal surgery. And he agreed, yes, that's painful. Let me help you with that. And so he gave me some pills, but they're still not enough. And so I ended up going to some extra doctors and meeting new friends that could prescribe these pills for me. And so I had all these people. I was having to keep up with all these prescriptions and manage that. And so that's a bit problematic. The greater dilemma comes when these doctors that may not know you as well because of their desire to make sure that you remain healthy, they start cutting you off. And so that started happening to me. And so I wasn't having enough pills. But I'm a keen observer of society in general and of these guys' offices, and I noted one of these doctors left his prescription pads in the room where they had put the patient. And I'm not a doctor and I'm not a pharmacist, but I do write prescriptions. And and so, really, for the ease of the doctor's office, this way they did not have to mess with phoning things in and all that kind of stuff. I started writing prescriptions. You know, if you write prescriptions on a daily basis, sooner or later you get into trouble. And that's what happened to me. And sort of to boil it down to how I first got to AA is I forged these things long enough that finally I got caught and I got arrested and I got an attorney. And I could have gotten out on a first offender status. But, you know, I had no defense against the first drink, no defense against the first drug, no defense of just getting out of me. And so before it's all over with, I kept doing that kind of thing, and I got arrested again. And when they arrested me the next time, before it's all over with, I was charged with forgery, robbing a drugstore, assault, and yeah, I really thought they were hamming up the charges, but they weren't. All these things really happened. Now, this wasn't like robbing a drugstore, going in with a pistol and all this kind of stuff. I sort of figured out how I could snatch some meds when they weren't looking. But I got caught for that stuff, and I found myself in real trouble. And so I hired this attorney, and the attorney gave me some information, none of it very good. One of it was, you're going to need to go to AA. And so my first AA meeting was in 1990, 10 years before I got sober. It was on a Sunday night. It was around January 23rd of that year. It was at 7 p.m., and it was Super Bowl Sunday. I can tell you, I did not feel happy, joyous, and free at my first AA meeting. He told me this other thing. He says, Robert, you're facing serious charges. You've got a number of felonies. He said, we're going to be able to plea bargain that down from maybe 10 years down to 2 years. But I hate to tell you this, but you're going to prison. And I said, prison? I'm a jail guy. I'm not a prison guy, you know. You give me a few days or a few weeks, and I can mark those off the calendar, but prison means a year or more. So I said, well, I'm going to go to AA. I started going to AA, and I'd like to tell you that I came, got a sponsor, sobered up, and all that kind of stuff. But the truth is I was able to dodge the bullet. I did not have to go to prison. There was prison overcrowding. They looked at what my crimes were, and the assault was something that they could let go, that normally they stick you in jail for that kind of stuff. And so I was on long-term or intensive probation for a year and long-term probation for 10 years. During that time, I found a way to dodge the probation officers and still drink. So I was facing going back to jail for 10 years. And when we read that alcohol is cunning, powerful, baffling, it really, really is. And I was willing to give up my freedom so that I could keep drinking. So I show up, and here's how I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. It's April 10th, 2001. Let me mention, I do have a home group. It's the Fifth Tradition Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Love to have you there. You can come tonight, 7 p.m. It's a speaker meeting. It's held at Briarcliff United Methodist Church. We also have a big book study Thursday nights at 8 p.m. So it's April. It's 2001, and I'm getting real close to my sobriety date. It's on spring break. I didn't mention, we'd adopted a son during this time, 1987. We got a phone call. We weren't able to have kids. We got a phone call from the adoption agency. They said, do you want to pick up this little baby boy? He's 2 days old. And Teresa and I ran down there and picked up that boy down in Thomasville, Georgia. he had grown up. He was 14 at this point, and it was spring break, and we had been down at Tampa, Florida, and my wife got a call from her work, and she had to get back home. So she came back home on a Wednesday. Of course, I came back. We all came back, and she was going back to work. I thought, I'll go back to work on Thursday, save my vacation days. I get back to town on Wednesday, so I go to the Buckhead Saloon. That's where people went on Wednesday night, the guys I hung out with. I end up getting drunk. Go to work on a Thursday, and I was feeling not too good, but I knew what to do about that. I did the things I usually did. I went to work. I took a handful of pills with a cup of coffee, and it's those same kind of pills like I was taking before. And I hadn't really paid attention to the number that I took, and so I'm walking around. I get this feeling. I've gotten this feeling before. Next thing I know, it's boom. Man, I'm out, and I'm on the floor, and I'm sort of shaking like this. And in the back of my mind, I hear people say, call 911. Robert's down. And so next thing I know, they've hauled me off the hospital. I'm at Piedmont Hospital, and, you know, I wake up, and I'm in a mess. I sort of wake up, and there's light shining in my face like this, and nurses with masks on, they're saying things like, breathe, Mr. Bell, breathe, you know. And so I'm coming out of it, and when you wake up, you realize a couple things. They tell you you got to call somebody to pick you up because they don't like bring your car with you. You can't just go out and catch MARTA. They want somebody to sort of observe you for a bit. So I had to call my former wife, Teresa. I'll never forget what she says when I tell her on the phone where I was. And this is the woman who'd picked me up out of jail and gone to court with me and on the first trip to the hospital. And she says, Robert, is there any hope? Well, when you're getting asked, is there any hope, that's about the time you need to be showing up to AA, because that desperation is closing in on you. And I really didn't know what I had hope in. But she comes and gets me, and the doctor looks at me and my wife. He looks at me and he says, you told the nurse you took a handful of pills. You didn't even count them. Weren't you afraid of a overdose? And I thought, no, doc, I'm afraid of that dreaded underdose is what I'm afraid of, see? I'm always worried that there's not enough booze. There's not enough anything. And so I get out. My wife, she was a really thoughtful person. And when we got home, she had packed bags for me. So I got packed off, and I ended up in Peachford. Now, Peachford is a mental institute. Let me ask this question. How many people have been to the mental institute? Looks like a lot of people. How many people have been to jail? A lot of the same people. I have to tell you, though, I like the mental institute a lot better than jail, and I could give you a whole host of reasons. The day room is a lot safer, you know. But a couple of interesting things happened in the mental institute. While I was there, members of Alcoholics Anonymous brought meetings. And I'll never forget, they sat down. There's these three guys who were sitting behind a lunchroom table like this, and there was some patients on the other side, and they read from the title page of Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Thousands, it's broad-based. Men and women, it's inclusive. Recovered to regain our spiritual, mental, and physical health from alcoholism. And they talked about the disease of alcoholism like I did at the beginning. And so we sort of laugh at these squares that are bringing in meetings as they get to leave and the door clangs shut behind them and they get to go out and we get to stay in. See, I didn't understand that problem. And one other thing happened that I thought was important. This guy brought me into his office. It was a counselor, a social worker type. And he asked me a bunch of questions. Robert, have you ever been to AA? I said, yeah, everyone in the men's institute gets to go to AA. Yes, I've been to AA. And he said, did you work the steps? And I think in your heart of hearts, sitting here in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, everybody in the room knows if they've taken the 12 steps. They know if they've gotten on their knees and done a third step prayer with their sponsor. Have they written an inventory? Have they shared it? Have they asked for help from God for their character defects? Have they made amends? I knew I hadn't done any of that stuff. I said, no. He said, did you have a sponsor? And I said, in name only. He said, did you read the big book? I said, yeah. And he asked me a question. He says, well, what did Bill finally do when he got sober? And see, I might have read it. I say I might, I'm not even certain that I had, but I hadn't studied it. And what he is getting at, he said, Bill went back to the hospital where he got sober, and he told the people of his plan of rehabilitation, and that if they wanted to get better, they must do likewise. And he says, Robert, do you think AA can work for you? And of course, I'm not drinking, but I'm an untreated alcoholic. I have an answer for everything. So I started to answer the question. He says, no. Go back to the day room, talk with your friends. I just want you to think about it. So I go back to the day room, and I forget about that whole conversation until a long time later. So I get out of there, and I ended up at this treatment center called MAR. And it's sort of long-term treatment. I was there. But while I was there, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. They made us go to meetings, and I asked this guy to sponsor me. And I asked a guy that's walking around with a big book, and he said yes. The guy's name is Pat M., and he asked me a number of questions. One key question is, you're willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcoholism? And I said yes. And so we started meeting on a weekly basis, and I thought he'd, when he said meet, it'd be just meet him at the meeting. We met an hour early, and we did things like we'd make coffee, and we'd put out food if there's food to be put out. We'd put out literature. Then we'd read the big book, and we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the blank page right on through, and that's the way I took the steps. And, you know, it's crazy. We got to page 88, right after you've done step 11. He looked at me and says, Robert, you know what? You've done everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has asked you to do, and it's now your turn to help others. And I said, Pat, what are you telling me? He says, it's time for you to start praying for someone to help. I said, are you saying it's time to sponsor? He said, because I've only got like 5 or 6 months of sobriety. It's, you know, at a lot of meetings they say you have to have a year. And he says, Robert, if Bill waited a year before he sponsored anybody, he had died before he got around to Dr. Bob. And if Dr. Bob waited for Bill D. to show up for a year, Bill D. would have been long dead, and he might have been too. He's only 17 days sober. It's time for you to do the work. And so I started praying to find someone I could help, and before I knew it, I was sponsoring people. And meanwhile, my dad was sick. He had been living with us the last few years. My mom had died a number of years earlier, and he had actually had to go to the hospital. He had a pacemaker. He got an infection in the pacemaker. He is in his late 80s. But I can remember I went to visit him on a Saturday morning, and I'd taken the steps. I'd made amends with my dad, and my dad told me something that I think he'd been trying to teach me my whole life. And he said, you know, Robert, there comes a time when a man has to make peace with his God and his fellow man. That's sort of what he does. He said, with God and his fellow man. He says, I've done that, and I'm ready to meet my maker. Well, that's what sort of happened to me with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been shown all these things throughout my life, but I come to AA and I figure out how to make peace with God and my fellow man. That's the very thing that you guys taught me. You know, he died a couple days later. He died on a Tuesday, and I was able to be there with him, along with my wife and my 15-year-old son and my brother and his wife. We were able to hold his hand and read things that he'd want to have read and do prayers with him. And I was able to participate in the funeral because I'm a sober member of AA. There was people there from my home group, and I was able to sort of do the family eulogy. And my wife did a part of it, and my son Stuart got up, and he read the 23rd Psalm. Often read at funerals. Starts, the Lord is my shepherd. And I would have never thought that inside 1 year we'd be reading the 23rd Psalm at my son Stuart's funeral. Stuart died while he was 15 years old. He was an impulsive kid, and he died by completing the suicide act. I woke up on a July morning in 2002. I was only in my second year of sobriety, and my wife got in from running and said, get up, Stuart. He needs to go to soccer camp. So I went down the steps to the basement. As I walked around that last flight of steps, I looked ahead, and in this closet, there's a rope hanging down. Stuart's feet were on the ground, and his knees were nearly on the ground. And I really thought he was going to stand up and say, just kidding, Dad. But I ran over and held him. And, you know, there wasn't going to be any first aid. There wasn't going to be any CPR. And I ran up the steps and sort of in a sober blackout, if you will. My wife jumped out of the shower and said, Robert, what happened? And I told her Stuart's hung himself. And I asked her to call 911. And I went over and picked up my phone and called my sponsor, Pat. And Pat said, oh, my God, Robert, I'll be right over. Pat came over, and I remember it was like the first time I met him. He walked in, and he had these two books. And we stood by the coffee maker and made coffee. And EMTs were there. It's a crime scene. Police are there. They have to make sure that, you know, that it's not a crime. And it wasn't. It was just as it appeared to be. And so they did the things they need to do. And meanwhile, Pat and I sat down, a neighbor had come over, and Pat said, Robert, grab your big book. And I did, and he said, give it to John, and I gave it to him. He said, open to page 63, and we did the third step prayer. And it goes like this, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help, with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I believe that prayer was honored that day. That morning I got up and did what I did this morning. I got on my knees and asked God for help. Asked him to relieve me of the obsession to drink. I did the third step prayer. I talked to a couple alcoholics on the way coming up here. I'm at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That day I'd gotten up, I'd talked to alcoholics, I'd prayed. And I'd planned to go to work and do the stuff I was supposed to. And then when calamity hit, you know, I call my sponsor. So Pat's there. Next thing I look out the window, and a friend of mine, Matt E., is pulling up. Then Art S. pulls up on his motorcycle. And I said, Pat, what's going on? He said, well, I call Matt. He's calling the gang. And so some of the guys that I sponsored showed up. Some of the other guys that Pat sponsored showed up. Next thing, the whole home group is there. A lot of times in AA, you hear people sort of hammer home the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm big on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a guy to guy that I sponsor that's here with me. If I sponsor you, we're going through the big book. I believe in the 12 steps. That's why we're here. But at every meeting, we talk about Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship of men and women. And, you know, the fellowship is all important. So I try not to diminish the importance of the fellowship. And people showed up, and they showed care and love for us. When I look back, it's a time that's really special. I saw the love of God that day in a way that I'll never forget. Charles Dickens begins a novel saying, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. You can understand the worst of times. It was the best of times because of the love that I shown that day, and I'll never forget that. You know, in the midst of the tragedy, things happened that I can laugh at now. So I get a phone call on Thursday. This happened on a Wednesday. On a Thursday, this guy, sponsor, called up, and he's drinking. And it's about 10:30, 11 in the morning. And I said, Brad, I got stuff I've got to take care of here. I need you to go to a meeting and get a white chip, or go home and sleep it off, but go to a meeting and get a white chip. So I stick the phone back in my pocket. My sponsor, Pat, stands there, and he says, Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world. I said, Pat, my son just died. He says, yeah, but if anyone should be drinking, it's you, and you've got a sponsee drinking for you. You're really lucky. It's good to have a sponsor. They see things from a different perspective. You know, I sort of need to wrap up, but I think there's several key things that I do want to point out. As life continues, when these kind of things happen, I need additional assistance. The big book talks about that there's great counselors, therapists, that when burned by alcohol, we certainly need to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But if I break my leg, I am not going to come here for help. I need an orthopedic surgeon. And with the death of a child and death by suicide, suicide carries a certain stigma. So I found this group of people that was peer-led, meaning it was led by others who'd lost people by suicide. I started going there and realized that you can talk about these things. There's not great shame that has to go with it or guilt. And they helped me learn to talk about it and just integrate this into my life. And it's sort of just part of my life. Doesn't mean I'd much rather have Stuart here. I think he'd be a member of AA by now because he'd be 30-something. But I'd much rather he be here. But what I found is I found a place of service where I can help people that have had to deal with suicide, because these groups that I used to go and participate in, they says, Robert, you seem to be able to communicate effectively. You talk about your experiences and what you've done to get better rather than telling other people what to do. See, I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to find this as a point of service where I can help people deal with loss by suicide. Unfortunately, that marriage did not survive. Living 20 years with an alcoholic actively and then a few years sober, a death of a child can cause problems. And my former wife, Teresa's remarried. We talk periodically. I talked with her just last month, and she's doing well. We follow up on things, and so I'm really pleased for her. And I am really blessed that I met another woman. She's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. We celebrate 10 years of marriage this month, at the end of the month. And so, you know, life continues. I've been able to stay employed. And, you know, if you're new in AA, I asked about that. If you're new in AA, I was taught things in AA that really helped me stay employed. And this is the key thing. I go to work. I stay at work. And what I do is I actually work at work. See? So I've been able to rebuild life. And, you know, if you asked me how I view my life, I really view it sort of the way that God does. God wants us to experience life being happy, joyous, and free. And that's the way I enjoy life. And I do it by having a sense of purpose. You know, for the new people, and everybody really, that counselor at Peachford asked me, he said, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? It's a great question, and I think it can work for anybody. And I think we get a real sense of purpose here in Alcoholics Anonymous by being able to help others. You know, we can find other purposes based on things that occur to us. And then we stay here and we work the steps. And, you know, I mentioned step 9, and that was one of the reasons that I brought up that whole drug thing. I probably not even bring that up in my story, but I get a chance to tell my story here and there. And so I told my story one time. This guy says, Robert, have you ever thought about getting a pardon? I thought, no, I really hadn't. And he gave me a few pointers of what I might could do. And so I applied for this pardon. And it was about 2007. And 2 years later, I got this letter from the Board of Pardons and Parole. And so I run into the house. I can remember it was April 9th because the day before my sobriety day. And I showed Carrie. I said, this is either really good news or it's really bad news. And I opened it up. And sure enough, I'd gotten pardoned by the state of Georgia for all those felonies and everything else I'd done. So I'm running around at my home group. I'm waving around, showing people, picking up a chip because it's right at the time of my, I guess it's eighth or ninth year. So I'm picking up a chip and show it to my sponsor. My sponsor reads it closely, and he reads this back to me. And it says, whereas, having investigated the facts material to the pardon application, which investigation established to the satisfaction of the Board of Pardon and Paroles that the pardon applicant is a law-abiding citizen and is fully rehabilitated. He said, they did not call me, you know. And so, you know, I really feel blessed to be a member of AA. AA is sort of the central focus of my life. When I say I'm an alcoholic, that's the most important thing. I get to have a sense of purpose. I get to have a host of friends. We get to see that fellowship build up among us. We get to be a part of things like the Allatoona Roundup, the Atlanta Roundup, a lot of things. So when I think about my life, my home group is important. The people I sponsor are important. My sponsor is important. And that's what allows me to have a family life and everything else. I'm going to close by reading one last thing. I've gone over a minute or two, but I think this is sort of key. And this comes out of the 12 and 12. When I was new, a guy that ran a beginner's meeting, he said, when you're new, you should buy a big book and a 12 and 12, read it and reread it. And I try and follow that direction. But on step 12, it says, furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeming failure or success? Can we now accept and adjust to either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable satisfactions when the brighter, more glittering achievements are denied us? The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep on trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for the many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, then they can become facts of life for many more. You know, I really believe that we can recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's applying the 12 steps to my life. It's by getting a relationship with a higher power and then reaching out and helping others. And I have a great life. And if you're new or been around a long time, my hope is that you've had the very same experience. And I want to thank Damon. I want to thank the Breakfast Club. And God bless.